first of all, I want to welcome you to the Asian American Research Institute. My name is Shamtoli Huck. I'm one of the board members here. I'm also a law professor at CUNY School of Law. Our executive director, Deanna, couldn't be here today, but she took the time to share a message. I wanted to read that. I want to welcome everyone to this evening's timely conversation between Danais and Gemini. Yeah, I'm sorry, Gemini, I know, like, online, so I'm like, I haven't had to call her yet. I'm sorry I could not join you all this evening, but I'm so glad that you are here, learning and sharing together. Okay, she thanks me. I'll skip that part. Thank you for introducing us to the fantastic work of these two authors. The themes in their work challenge us to re-examine gender, sexuality, and identity, which are especially important in light of our current sociopolitical moment, both domestically and internationally. We're reminded to embrace fluidity in our lives and in our understanding of each other. And above all, we question identity, the complexities of belonging, not belonging, and everything in between. And so with that, I'll also do a little plug that May 17th, we're having our annual symposium, which is around interrogating and questioning Asian American identity. So please come to that and just kind of keep out a look for that. So I'm going to introduce our authors tonight. It's like beautiful to see. I don't know. I'm just joyful to see the Bengali women doing their thing. Okay. Well, we have from Houston, right? Via Philadelphia, via all these places, Gemini Wahaj, and he's the author of the forthcoming short story collection, Looking Forward, to Katie Family from Jackleg Press. Her fiction is or forthcoming in publications including Granta, Third Coast, Chicago Quarterly Review, Flighty's Prime Number Magazine, Zone 3, Northwest Review. No, take your flowers. The Carolina Quarterly, Crab Orchard Review. I'm a lawyer and not a poet, and I know these are like really big deal. So I just want to tell you, these are really the top, you know, literary journals. So yeah, Arkansas Review. She has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Houston, where she received the James Michener Award for Fiction, judged by Claudia Rankine. So. Yep, and the Camera Imprint Fellowship. And she's an associate professor of English at Lone Star College in Houston. And maybe she'll talk about her amazing daughter, Maha, who I got to work with through a project. So she's just this other roles as well. And then Danais is the author of In Sensorium, Note for My People, winner of the 2022 Kirkus Prize in Nonfiction, and the critically acclaimed novel Bright Lines, which was a finalist for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, and the Edmund White Debut Fiction Award, and the Brooklyn Eagles Literary Prize. They're the recipient of residencies at McDowell, Tin House, and DeGerossi, if I'm...
It's just Gerossi, as far as I know.
And also an independent perfumer, their fragrance, beauty, and design. Check out their site. Is based in New York City. And they're working on a forthcoming novel called Stellar Smoke. And we're really appreciative for her to... She said, I'm writing, but I'll come out for this.
Just for Gemini.
Yeah, so this is really, really, really beautiful. So
I wanted to match Danais, because she writes about constructing an identity as a Bengali girl growing up in America. So I wanted to sort of contrast you. So I'm going to read from a part where there's a Bengali girl who is growing up in Bangladesh, and but dreams of coming to America. So this is sort of, I'm meeting you from the other side.
Oh my God, maybe I should read a little after.
No, please.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So, you know, like youth growing up, which I've only experienced as a mother here, and I've never understood the other side. You know, we've had a lot of struggles generationally, and it was really amazing reading your book and sort of having that speak back to me from the other side. So I'll read this.
Thank you.
So this is my generation. It's called Madman, and it's Chinaida 1995. And it's this girl who was not allowed to go to America because her parents were like, nah, you're a girl. So she studied at Dhaka University, but she never lost her going to America dream. 1995. It would take the steamer an hour to cross the Padda River. At first, Bina and her father sat outside on the deck above the giant water wheels with the spray of the river water on their faces. When the heat became overbearing, they moved inside the shaded cabin. Small ferry boys with earnest brown faces passed through the cabin with their wares hanging from their necks and arms, crying in loud voices, China badam, khabar kagoj. Nasiruddin bought the small jessore bananas called shobri kola, green coconuts full of fresh water, peanuts roasted in sand with salt and red pepper, and a copy of Jai Jai Din. Bina wore glasses like her father, but unlike him, who seemed entirely used to them, polishing them roughly with a towel or a shirt, peering at the world through the dirt stains and the fogged glass lenses, she never used hers. She had just finished her honors degree at Dhaka University, where she had discovered that beautiful women did not wear glasses. Your glasses are so dirty, Bina said in disgust, catching her reflection in her father's thick-rimmed spectacles. It's a wonder you can see anything through them. Realizing that she had just hurled all her insecurities about her own looks at him, she was immediately sorry and held out her hand to receive the peanuts in the small paper cone bag that he had been badgering her to try. Bina's friends at university were bookworms like her. They ate up Shakespeare's sonnets and all his plays and all the romantic poetry in their courses, calling out lines from English poems during casual conversation and analyzing their everyday experiences through the eyes of the English literature they studied. But they missed out on everything else about being a university student. Only recently during their master's degrees had they started to apply lipstick, buy fashionable shalwar kameez at the new boutiques, shampoo the oil out of their hair, style them in layered cuts at the beauty salon, and venture out to TSC, the Dhaka University Teacher Student Center, teeming with campus life, to listen to Bengali poetry recitations. They had already started planning how to go to America, the land of the TV series MacGyver and Charlie's Angels, and the music icons Bruce Springsteen, John Bon Jovi, and Michael Jackson. Bina's university friends thought that marriage was the ticket to America, the most desirable boys to marry, holding the highest prospect of going abroad, were the engineers next door. One day, on the pretext of visiting Bina's school friend Salma, a student at the engineering university, the four friends walked the length of Fuller Road to the neighboring campus. Standing under the shade of the Krishnachura trees, framed by a canopy of flaming red flowers, they smoothed their hair and stared at the young men in open-neck shirts with rolled-up sleeves, walking in the sun, surveying the land with measuring tools. Bina realized that she didn't want to marry someone who would go to America to pursue their passions. She wanted to go to America to pursue her own dreams. Salma and Bina began to gather information on how to apply to graduate programs in America, collecting GRE and TOEFL books and faded Xerox copies of practice exams from all the senior bhai and appa already on their way to the States. Bina and her father were traveling to Bina's uncle Asif Chacha's house in Chinaida, where all her father's siblings would gather to discuss how her grandfather's property should be divided. It was her grandfather's wish, or perhaps his children's wish, to sort out their inheritance before he died. Her father had invited her to come with him, describing the occasion to her as a happy family reunion. Only her mother had hinted darkly about the ugly business to be conducted. Why do you only say negative things about my father's family? Bina had frowned. You look down on them because they are villagers. Bina, I am only saying, Rahila had crossed her plump arms defensively. Your father is not a practical man. He does not know how the world works. Just keep an eye on him. Now Nasiruddin turned to Bina and smiled. His attention was more sharply focused on her now that her brother Lenin had gone abroad to study in the States. Your dada will be very happy to see you, he said, speaking of Bina's grandfather. Bina nodded awkwardly. The few times Dada had visited their flat on the university campus in Dhaka, he had slept on the narrow divan in the dining room where they ate and watched TV. During the day, he rolled up the bedclothes and the mosquito net and sat on the divan, his long back bowed, following their movements with his eyes, waiting silently for one of them to talk to him. Ishwa Ma, come here, he called to Bina gently in a gravelly voice. But Bina felt too shy to sit near him or speak to him. Ammu, Appu, talk to your dada, Nasiruddin requested Bina and Lenin in a melodramatic, choked voice. Look how he sits there all day waiting to talk to you. Think about how far he comes to see you. I'm heartbroken that you don't speak to your grandfather. Nasiruddin himself never spoke to his father. If he spoke to him at all, it was to scold him in an angry voice with a deep frown on his forehead. Aha! What are you doing? Don't touch the dal spoon with the hand that you are eating with. That hand is dirty. He acted as if he himself were a guest in his wife's city home, and to fit in the social circle of the city, he had to sever his ties with his relatives from his village home. Now, as Bina made the same journey as her grandfather, enduring the chaotic bus stop in Gaptoli, the hours in traffic jam to the Dhaka-Aricha highway, and the long wait at the river ghat to board the ferry, she marveled that her grandfather, an old man, had undertaken this arduous journey at all. She imagined him now disembarking the bus at the crowded terminal at Gaptoli, hailing a rickshaw to the engineering university campus. He would appear at their flat, bending his tall frame and his round bald head to step through the doorframe and smile at them with crooked teeth, his long weather-beaten face glowing with happiness. As soon as Dada sat down on the divan in the dining room, Rahila, which is Bina's mother, pulled a chair opposite the old man and started to scold him, accusing him of depriving the children of his first wife, reminding him how his second wife had mistreated the children of his first wife, complaining about how the children of his second wife were trying to steal all their father's lands. Dada listened with his head bowed. After Rahila had gone on for a long time, he rose abruptly and said he was going downstairs. When Bina's father returned home from the university, her grandfather would not be there. Who knows where he went? Perhaps he walked with long strides on the dusty city streets, taking in with wide eyes the strange city that was now his son's home. When the steamer touched land in Khulna, hawkers climbed aboard and angled their way through the third-class and second-class cabins, carrying chicken, fish, and mangoes on their heads, crying out the names of the items they were selling. Standing on deck, Bina watched the coolies balance the passengers' heavy suitcases on their heads, their necks throbbing under the weight of their loads. She was touched by the solidity of these men's burdens, who appeared to her to resemble the heroic men of Beowulf, sailors and warriors of another time. Oh, how she wished to belong to something so solidly. She was glad that she was going home to visit her father's family, who loved her, but from whom she had been kept apart by her mother's snobbery. She had visited her father's village only a few times as a child, and each time, upon returning to Dhaka, Rahila had complained to her sisters about the long journey, the unclean water, and the poisonous snakes.
So I make perfume and I write, and I am a writer, but I use perfume as another way to sensuously express myself and tell a story. So I just want to read a very small part about where my project lies. Mm-hmm. And I'm fasting right now, so I want to just acknowledge that in the part that I'm reading, because I started this book, Ramadan 2020, I think it was. So time flies. Oh my God, it's 2024. Shit. Okay. So, hello. Scent is a savior for people in exile and diaspora, said my friend Dana El Masri, an Egyptian-Lebanese perfumer living in Montreal. I make perfume to encapsulate the notes of dish, homeland that has never been my home. Perfume would be the shortest route to my grandmother after her death. Gondho is a perfume, aroma, or a stink. Gondho is my pilgrimage through the vast syncretic lineage that I've inherited. Dravidian, Sufi, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Persian, Afghan, Turkish, Indian, Pakistani, snake goddess worshiper. As Western modern thought and whiteness evolved during European colonization, the sense of sight ascended to prominence. Smell became associated with primitive and barbaric people. They imagined man as separate from nature, severing the connection to the feminine and the sacred. A perfume collects these fragmented histories into a single borderless substance, a seamless composition of oils and resins distilled from plants that might be strangers in nature, from countries with a violent colonial relationship, like French lavender and Haitian vetiver. By collecting fragrant materials, what Saidiya Hartman calls the degraded material of the archive, and transforming them into a new composition, I found a way to wrest back our memories, bodies, stories, and smells from the hard damage of colonization. This book is shaped like a perfume built from the perspective of a perfumer. First, I lay down the patrimyths, which are the lies of history, that's what I call them, that protect the powerful. The heavy bass notes of history, of South Asia and my childhood, a foundation for the heart notes, collected stories from the women in my family, feminine love and desire, the unimaginable violence imprinted on survivors, which is a huge topic for us as Bangladeshi women and femmes, all the way to the top notes, the invitation to a fragrance, touch points akin to a pilgrimage, psychedelic experience, and a spiritual awakening. Using degraded material, a perfume emerges as a sensuous act of resistance. When my grandmother fell ill, her youngest son drove her around for 8 hours just to find a hospital that would admit her in Dhaka. Roads, hospitals, futures, nothing was ever guaranteed. And when Nanu passed, she died without being touched or loved or soothed, alone, without her children or her grandchildren near her, all of her kin scattered across the world. The meaning of diaspora is a scattering, like seeds. We were so far from her when she left us. I fasted for Ramadan when she ascended to ancestor. Hunger radiated through my body. Every sensation became strangely heightened. The longing, sorrow, lust, and fear for where our world was headed. This is in 2020. I was separated from my family. We were unable to mourn Nanu's passing together, unable to console my own mother as she grieved. Nanu crossed oceans throughout her life to see us in the States, but she never set foot on the silvery waters of the Bay of Bengal. She never stood at the edge of her own homeland. Her body is buried next to my grandfather in his ancestral village. She was a portal between this world and an older world that I'm descended from, a world that I feel in my bones but will never know. Thank you so much.
Okay,
you want me to start? Okay, so
I start with you is that you've reviewed her book.
I've learned
and,
that.
And said essential new addition to the Bengali diasporic literary landscape. So I thought we'd start with you to say just reflections on the book, parts that resonated with you as a writer, and then whatever you'd like to share.
So I think one of the most interesting things when you're writing fiction about diaspora is that you're trying to balance telling the story of someone who is in Bangladesh, who has left Bangladesh. There's a multi-generational aspect. You're dealing with class. You're dealing with stories that are outwardly expressed and stories that are internally very, you know, vibrant worlds. And I think the balance between Bina and Nasiruddin, we get someone who's in the States and dealing with how constricting life can be in the States. And it's almost like this is the land of freedom, so-called freedom, but there's more constriction in one's world, more judgment and more performance of how one should act. And then when we get to the Nasiruddin sections, there is this freedom and explosion of language and color and life. But when you think of a Bengali father and how he actually communicates in life, not often is he being that expressive in his life. This is very much like an internal landscape that comes alive with the author's deft hand working through imagination to tell his story. So it's almost like the land of freedom and opportunity. I felt a constriction in the character's experience. And then in these places that through the imperial point of view of the US, like Iraq or Bangladesh, that are, you know, deemed backwards, whatever. I mean, the words that are being used right now to describe people who come from Muslim countries, but there's such an opening in how people can move, how the landscape is described, even the part that you read, there's an aliveness to it because there's not such an obsession with like money, perfection, power, all these things. So that's like one of the things that I really took away from the book. Has anyone read the book in the room? Like, Shumi's like, whoa, amidst reading. So I definitely, you know, encourage you to pick it up because I think like our generational, like we're like half generations apart. I'm into timelessness, but I think our experiences do reflect moments in time in a different way. Like I grew up as a third grader in the Gulf War. And I remember one of the things my parents were always telling me, don't, my last name is Islam, so Tanayis is Tonni Nondini Islam. They're like, don't tell people our last name. Don't tell people we're Muslim. Like, there was very, it was something to protect. It was a secret to protect. So we were in Missouri. So in Texas, it's kind of like some of the Bangli people are co-signing what's happening, and there's a tension. And I think the tension among people in diaspora is something that is infinitely interesting to explore. Mm. We're not all, I think, and I want to talk more about this because Jhumpili has great questions, but.
Well, actually, it relates because you actually talk about sort of the geography, the way
yes,
that
yes.
you're writing too.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's very common about their writing is that it's text, but I feel transported, like I'm there, you know? I'm just sort of like, the just the passage that you read. And similarly, I mean, I haven't read Sensorium, but in
Right Lines.
Similarly, I just have this visual of climbing the back, you know, kind of getting in mm-hmm. like late, and it's almost like cinematic, right? And so the writing is so cinematic. So there is that kind of like aliveness that you talked about. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you wanted to, that was sort of intentional or both. I saw that sort of a commonality in terms of like writing, or maybe I was trying to sort of, it mm-hmm. felt very, there was a sort of a resonance across the both mm-hmm. of the writings. It's not just like, oh, these are words and like you're telling me what's happening. It's like I'm almost there. Mm-hmm. Like I'm in that room in Brooklyn. I'm in these places that you're kind of transporting me to, which made it such a really beautiful read for both writers. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we both have like a father with secret dreams. I feel like the repressed dad is one of our characters and the mom who's sort of like more in his face. I don't know. I guess I would love to hear, you know, how you felt to write these different locales. And
I think my writing is very romantic, but not romantic as in romance, but romantic about, we tell narratives, right? And I guess it's a very dominant narrative, but it's a very romantic narrative about mm-hmm. these places that are sort of not accessible, right? Like mm-hmm. I can't go back to this place that I'm writing about. And I was talking about Sayyed Mushtabali's writing mm-hmm. recently, and mm-hmm. You can see that like he's writing about a place like Afghanistan mm-hmm. at a certain point, 1920s,
right.
that doesn't exist. So to me, like that Dhanmundi doesn't exist, that Bonani
yes.
doesn't exist,
right.
that village my father can never, he's dead, but you know, he could never go back to, mm-hmm. it doesn't exist. So these vanishing spaces,
yeah.
and I think for us from colonized spaces, that's even mm-hmm. more true. Like,
Yeah, because it's like not even in their hands. I think that was mm-hmm. one of the themes in my book that I center on the woman and femme and queer space. But I think to think about, and I think about my grandmas a lot because they both were married very young and didn't really have a say in the world around them. But it transformed dramatically in their entire lifetime. So I think that's the thing. It's like these worlds are being destroyed mm-hmm. by forces outside of a nuclear family's actual, mm-hmm. what they're putting out into the world and what they're experiencing. I guess one of the things that I think is really, I think with the character of Bina, like she has like a tortured artist soul.
Oh, I identified with her.
I identified with that. Did you feel like that when you were writing her? Like I just didn't you feel like
what's
she was tortured because she was like not expressing herself in the wild, crazy way she wanted because she was a little too in the pocket of the community a little bit.
Right, because I wanted to say, so the story is that Bina's trying to get her citizenship and be quiet and get married and get, you know, get whatever.
Good Bengali.
Yeah, and so she's not going to talk about the Iraq War, like she's ignoring it. In order to make her that way, I couldn't make her also passionate or imaginative. Because she's not in that space.
She can't be in that space. But that is so... So that's the thing that I felt like was so interesting. Is like, you can't actually have that level of ease if you are critiquing the things that, you know... I mean, even here, like now, if you're an immigrant and you're caught at a protest saying something about the American government, I mean, you could get deported, right? I mean, this is, like, on the table. So the fear that she's sort of operating in. But she still finds some people a little bit more, like, they're even more colonized than her. I feel like she's
like
still...
They're bought out.
Yeah. They're like, the Americans are fighting so hard for us. Like,
I know, that was...
It's kind of chilling. And I guess I wanted to talk about, like, you know, Chomptali and I are more in the New York context. I'm like a little more upstate. You're like Queens, and where are you?
Yeah.
Bronx. But you didn't live in Queens ever?
No.
You never did?
No.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's okay.
You're like...
I was like, I know.
Well, no, then we're closer to each other.
Like Queens girls and Bronx like, girls are very different.
The Bronx girls have come to Bear Mountain where I live, so you guys were closer.
Well, for Noah Khalid to Bronx, that was my journey, so...
So basically, like, the New York context of Bengalis is so different from Texas, and I would love
to hear about that
because I feel like we don't have that.
We don't have
experience.
Yeah, I was complaining the very first time I talked to you. I was complaining about, you're like, no, that's not how New York is. So that's really.
I feel like we're all pretty sweet and loving to each other when we meet. We've all been like smiling at each other. I'm joking.
This is being televised, right? It's live streamed, so we can't really say everything that we want to say.
Because you have to go back.
Right,
You're not being up. You're not being
up. But I want to know, like, the tea, like, who are these people? Because I don't think I've ever encountered a Bangladeshi in New York who was like, they're really fighting for...
The man.
I was talking to Iram, who was like, oh, everyone's very conformist in the suburbs. And that's how it feels. Like, it's very, like... We want this. You have this drawing room. I want this drawing room. You have this car.
But
I want this car.
That's religiously, that's different. But politically, interestingly enough, yes, there's separation, there's religiosity. But the politically, at least in terms of growing up in New York, it's very clear around where the community stood on Iraq and now Palestine.
And 9/11 especially.
9/11, Palestine, I'm just wondering. So that's why I think one of the questions for both of your writings, I do talk about, like, ask about location, like Brooklyn, Bangladesh, like orientation and perspective. So I do have relatives in Houston, so I was like, oh, I'm curious, like, is that a different, is it class, is it their professions, or here my experience has been across class. In Iraq, I mean, I remember protesting and getting actually arrested. And for a die-in, and everyone's like, yay, you know, it was like, that's not usually, you know, it's not yay, your South Asian parents are like, get arrested. No.
Is yay.
But for Iraq, them, yay. For Palestine, yay. Yeah. But not for... So I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in New York. I went to school in the Northeast. Yeah. I went to school in Philadelphia. Yeah. I lived in New York. And then when I got married, I came to Houston to study. We both came to study. And I was like, where am I? This is not America. But I was also married. So for the first time, I was able to enter Bengali society.
Because you actually count.
I'm married. And at first I was ecstatic. You know, like I was just like, oh, I'm not an imposter. Like I have an entry into this world. And it was very, I think also the society changed. It became horrific. Like it became almost a trap for me. Mm. And I kept trying to adjust and trying to understand. And I feel like I lost 20 years of my life just trying to sort of accept and understand. Like I used to wear, now I don't even remember that person. I used to wear like a nose ring and like a deep, and I had like a very like very Bengali look, and people would talk about me, so I stopped that. I would wear like
like you're too they were religious or something.
Yeah, they're okay. Like, oh, we don't do that. So I would try to, you know, just slowly change, and then so that, you know, I could remain friends because people liked me. And then I would wear sleeveless blouses, and then people would be like, oh my god. So I would stop that, and I just kept trying to hide myself because you know, I'm pretty, I don't know what the word is, but I, you know, I grew up here, and right. I mean, not, I didn't grow up here, but I went to school here.
I see.
I don't know your personal journey.
I mean, I went to university here.
University, so not, okay.
Yeah. And, but I was constantly trying to hide my opinions and try to hide myself, but people still know.
So are you Bina? I don't know, it just seems really...
No, I'm not.
Not the character, Bina, because no. there's
You're
no
not
part
supposed to ask a writer.
I don't know, I could ask whatever.
That's why we wrote a whole fictional account.
Yes, yes.
Because you were trying to hide.
No, but I didn't think it was you in terms of how I know you.
Like, is that your life story?
No, not your life story, but I think what you talked about, feeling constricted, it's not your life story, but feeling constricted to be able to identify this because I think it's not even like external colonization, it's a lot of women feel self-imposed.
Right, yeah.
Because the consequences of non-conforming is so great.
It's isolation. It's a generational thing, too. Yeah. Not that I did, but I just noticed, like, some apus that were a little older, they did get the arranged marriage thing going, even though they grew up in the U.S. their whole life, and they felt like they couldn't share a lot of their more weird emotions and feelings, and I feel like that's progressively getting...
worse.
I mean, in some ways, but it's also shifting. I think Gen Zs are like, I mean, you have kids, right? Mm-hmm. How old are they?
I have a 22-year-old.
So they're doing what, you know,
they want.
Yeah. They're like complete. So do you, I guess with the, you know, talking about Nasiruddin, like the character of, you know, father, I mean, he's also dealing with the shift from being from the Gram and then going
to,
you know,
yeah,
like just the city, marrying a woman, like, who's more, I don't know, how would you describe Rahila? Like,
more, like, urban, more...
Urban, her expectations are, like, sophisticated. Yes. She could be a bit of a hard ass. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not... there is a dynamic there, and he's always passing to, like... And I think about passing a lot, because passing...
Yes.
For your social class, I think for Bangladeshi people... I don't know if everyone feels this way, but passing as Indian in certain spaces to get ease. I've done that, like when I, my first name looks, it's spelled T-A-N-W-I, there's an Indian look to it, so people don't assume I'm Muslim, so sometimes I'll use that to have ease in a moment. Not as much now, but when I was younger.
No, but sometimes that's helpful. I mean...
just passing, right?
Yeah.
So there's,
I like the word ease of the moment.
I remember my daughter used to get on the phone, like to put an order in or something, and I would hear her saying... oh, hi, this is Maya.
Like, what? Is that not her name?
No, that's not her name.
Mom.
And I would get so mad, and I think it took me years to understand why she would do that. You know, why she felt compelled to...
I'm just an Indian woman who loves my yoga and ordering something right now.
And she told me, like, until she found radical, you know, like, radical societies, she was able to, like, say, oh, why am I doing this?
And interrogate it a little bit more.
And just feel freed from it.
Yeah, so what was the process of writing these two characters that are so disparate? Like, what is your writing day like when you're approaching this? I mean, I'm assuming, like, you've been working on this for a long time.
I just wrote it in one go many years ago, and it was...
Whoa!
But then
give me that energy.
And it was sort of... it was written very differently. It was sort of an interrogation. So the daughter was like, how did I get here?
Okay,
I don't have a house. Yeah. My friends have houses. I don't have a husband. I don't have citizenship. You know, all the things that I want. And it's really... I think it is really scary. You know, sometimes I look at newcomers to America, and I forgot that if you don't have... you know, if you're on an F1 and you have to leave.
The security.
And, the security issue is kind of scary. And so that's how she feels. Like, oh, my God, people have a house. I don't even know how that feels. Mm. And so she's blaming her father and the way he lived and his idealism. Mm. And so she starts that book by saying, how did we get here? And so it's an interrogation. Mm. So, for example, if he goes to Canada and he says, Canada's a great country, then she would say, like, but, you know, they're...
imperial, and he would be like, no, that's fine. You know, I think in every time people have oppressed other people, and that's fine. Like, everyone's oppressed everyone. And so there's this kind of...
Like a back and forth.
An interrogation, mm-hmm. yeah, so that the dominant narrative could be challenged through sort of questions and italics, but it was all his story, like the entire story.
Oh, so then it you shifted that structure.
To a dual narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Was that hard to kind of...
Yeah, it was horrible.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
I'm kind of struggling with that now.
Yeah.
So I can relate. Yeah, I mean, do you want to...
Yeah. No, I love the dual narrative, actually. Yeah. There's something about it. I mean, I was like this... I was leaving, and I told my husband, like, it should be like a movie. Mm. I feel like I'd watch... Because there's scenes coming out, and I can almost visually, like, see these characters. And so... yeah, no, I think we've touched on some of the themes, and I also want each of for us to ask questions. But, you know, gender, obviously, and identity figure pretty heavily in both of your work. So, yeah. And you talked about that a little bit, but I don't know if you want to...
Yeah, I want to know, like...
Turn the mic on.
Yeah, the gender conformity and, like, how that felt. Like especially in I'm assuming in a very heavily policed community.
For me, like... Yeah. Reading your book or
no,
just
you.
Me?
Yeah.
I mean, I have to be honest, like, I think I'm like I'm a fighter, so I'm not actually okay with being told, you know, your bra is showing, sleeveless board, but not this. I don't listen to that. But for me, it was kind of like, I was definitely like pushing against it. And I would be at a milad and be like, well, would you get a heart transplant from a pig? That's what they're doing now. And the uncles would be like, you're insane. Like, what's wrong with you? Go home. Like, you're so annoying. And I was like, I am annoying. And I just feel like there is something about a writer that is exposing and annoying. And that's why they're so feared. And you even have a whole chapter about intellectuals being, you know, basically murdered because of the Pakistani... Like, that's what's happening now in Palestine, too. It's like, you go after the people that hold
are
the...
free thinkers.
They're free thinkers that hold the score of the society, you know, that are the poets and the dreamers. So I always wanted to honor that because I felt like, in my family... They did respect that. And I really, like my father, he sings. And like, I just felt like this was a part of something I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. But when I was in a play, I was like 21. And in my bio, it was like, I am a queer Marxist feminist. And all that, my dad was like, what the fuck is that? We need to have a talk. Like, what is going on? He was like, what are all these words? Like, what are you saying right now? And I was like, I am queer, and I'm not gonna like hide from you anymore. Yes. And I was like really feeling strong in that, and still do to this day, and my sister as well. And the man took a pen and paper out and was like writing down what I was saying.
Aww.
And I was, and he has come a long way, but I feel like the porosity and the change of a man in our society. He's a cisgender heterosexual man. It is possible, so I just always believe in that for all of us. Like, young kids hit me up, and they're like, I want to be an artist, I don't know how to tell my parents, and I'm like, if you want it, you got to do it.
Yeah.
You came on this planet to do your life. So that's been my approach, and I think that is something that I do think can exist in any place, regardless of your nation state.
That's so true, yeah.
It's like, it's just your energy. And when I go to Bangladesh, like, I'm not from Bangladesh, but I do end up meeting people who are artsy, that wear the casual and like to stay up all night smoking cigarettes and talking about politics. Like, I always find those people wherever I go. So, I don't know, that's kind of like who I always have wanted.
Those are kin, like
my kinfolk, yeah.
But do you want to
share the same
some
thing.
More about
that?
And I think your characters, I think.
No, I think, talking about my characters, that you misconstrue that, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be like, this is what I'm supposed to, and that's what leads you on the wrong journey,
right?
Like, Bina's obviously heading toward, you know, like, all the things that she thinks she's supposed to do. But if you think, oh, this is who I am, and I think there's like a facade, a lying, the same way you lied to your parents because you think this is what your parents want from you. The moment you stop and you're yourself, you get everything that you want.
And the dynamics change as they age. I think you cover that really well too, because the aging father, it's like it's different. I mean, we see him from being a kid, and it kind of like really it breaks your heart because you see
how he was,
how much in mourning he's been broken. Like he doesn't feel entitled to his children's, like his child's life in a way. Like there's something that, I don't know, it just touches my heart when I think about the father as a figure, the archetypal figure who loses that kind of power and becomes like more normal, more soft,
More defenseless.
More defenseless.
Yeah.
And that is the process of being old. I mean, you become more like a child eventually, right? So you see like this arc for him, I think.
I think I'm just calling out people in the audience. One, but Anika, I think when she wrote about her father, right? Like, she's like, oh good, like you wrote about your father, like wanting to go back to his village, like that was his last wish, always one, and that was my father's last wish. Like he was like, he couldn't take care of himself, but he was like, you know, tumra amake, you know, leave me there, and I will, because you, all you want to do is go back to your child, because your childhood is where your memories are stored. And
but also, I mean, it seems like there's also trauma here. I mean, I don't want to like, there is some intergenerational trauma in this, and so. So part of going back, I wonder, is it to go back to sort of like resolve or to come to some resolution of the, or is it just literally to go back to see? I feel like there's more going on there, but I mean,
I feel like those are where, that's where all your happy memories are, and all you want to do is go back, but your family's like, no, you can't go back. We can't go back, so therefore you can't go back. We can't look after you, and it's an impossibility.
But the second wife and the sort of being mistreated and like not going to school seems very difficult, like seems like a memory.
It wasn't a happy memory.
That's what, so I think like it's so interesting how just about memory. You know, I just was a couple of years back was sort of recounting my own journey, and I found a picture, and you know, I don't think, you know, my parents are separated, and I was like, I always saw them separated. And I saw this picture of them, like, you know, just what they had come in the early 70s, and just like, just very, I mean, like lovey-dovey, and I was like, oh, I don't have any memory of this, and it was like, and then when I start to recall, like, it was like, oh, there were these beautiful memories, so that all of these things can kind of coexist. Like, I just sort of wonder if, like, we want to set up this binary of, like, good girl, bad girl, like I think, or just that it's all these like these layers that we're sort of dealing with, and depending on the context. So I saw him, like first I was like, I don't really like this character, this dad, right? But then once later we learned about sort of his upbringing, I softened to him and I understood that desires of the parent that never get fulfilled, like he never really, you know, so there's a sort of loss, but like, yeah, there's a different kind of romanticism. So it's just interesting, and all of the characters, there's like this
unfulfilled.
There's a like a a bit of a just a lament, there's a little bit of a lament there.
Can you talk about how it has felt to debut and be received by Bengali people? I just wanna talk about that, because I actually deal with this a lot, so I feel like it would be great to hear.
What do you deal with?
Just like either very like loving and affirming emails to like very like negative, like what business do you have talking about our lives type of thing, and it's not every day or anything. I'm not that important to be harassed every day, but I think it hits you different because it just has an edge to it. I don't know if you want to even talk about this, but I am curious because I think like one of the questions that you have that I'll just bring up because we're talking about it is for the Bengali writer. I mean, there's no shortage of Bengali writers.
Right.
So
I want to talk about that.
But like in the US context, it has been Jhumpa, Chitra Banerjee, Deva Karuni, who's your friend, right? Or you work with her, your teacher. So,
Bharati
Mukherjee.
There are Bengali.
Many names. But, and like women, and like people that have, you know, distinguished themselves. But usually there is, they're Indian, or there's a caste privilege, or there's something that is still a boundary between our experience. So I still feel like our diasporic canon is growing and is,
yes,
you know, the landscape is still being formed. It's being terraformed by us, essentially. Yes. So yeah, I mean, Ed, what are your thoughts on kind of how it feels to do that work, how it feels to be received for it? Like,
I mean, as a person, I think I'm unique.
You know, yeah, like, yeah, that's what I want to hear about.
And my
that.
Experiences, like you said, my experiences in Houston are unique. And it's, I felt like the stories I was telling were not stories that had been told, obviously, because I look at the world differently. And you know, I'm writing about Shumon and Mohsin and Khaled, and those are not people.
Oh, Khaled.
Yeah, there's, so there's.
It's like the fuckboy of the community.
So yeah, they're not.
Poor Khaled.
They've never been written about.
I'd probably be attracted to Khaled, honestly.
I felt like it was a metaphor for my attraction to the Bengali community.
It felt like that. Yeah, I was like, she's kind of still hot for him, though.
Yeah, because I keep going.
He's saying all the wrong things, and yes, like you're like, is. You're so dumb. Just stop talking.
Because I keep going back expecting something different.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, there's a new family that must be.
But he's just so tall, dark, and handsome that you can't say no to that second child.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So it's different. But do you feel that, like...
So I felt like my stories were important. In fact, my first book that I published was self-published. Like,
oh,
I took
really?
All my short stories that I'd written.
So this is a different experience for
you.
This is,
yeah.
So that's supposed to be nice.
It was really nice.
You're being held.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really amazing. Yeah,
oh, okay. So we stay on this path now.
Yes.
No more doing it all on our own.
Yeah. Right.
So how was your book received in Houston? Because you said you had sort of a push-pull relationship where you were trying to fit in, but then not trying to fit in, and you've been sort of in a more rebellion phase perhaps more recently.
Last 2 years,
Yeah. So how was your book...
Oh, can you tell me?
You said last 2 years?
Yeah.
That's it? Rebellion phase?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm just getting started, guys.
Are you wearing sleeveless blouses again?
Yeah.
Okay.
And,
mini-skirt?
They say that when you're like 50, you realize that everything that you've been told all your life was a lie. You know, like you're trying to be like, you know, like... walk the straight path, like in every way. Like I never did anything that would like be considered wrong ever, like in any way. And then you're like, what did I do with my life? Like who's this serving? And then suddenly you start doing everything and you're really happy. Yeah. So yeah, I
the question was about the receipt. How did the
There were no Bengalis at the book launch. It was full, like it was just a, you know, it was everyone I'd known for like 20 years, but there was no, there were like two
people.
No
Bengalis. One from the Houston? No.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because also there's a suburban urban divide. All the Bengalis live in the suburbs.
And your meetings were in the more downplaced.
Yeah.
Did you purposefully not invite them?
No, I invited them, but it's kind of unfair.
That's a good question.
It's unfair to expect, you know, suburban people to come
Why?
To this place.
Why?
It's unknown to them. They've never come here. Like, you know, like...
But you know them.
I know them, but it would be like, you know, for them to drive into the city, to park, would be an act of...
They not have read the book anyway, because it's your book. I think the main thing is...
Yeah,
what would they think reading this book?
Yeah, many Bengalis have read my book. Like, young women have read it and told me about it. Friends have read it, but like... From the community, like I know so many people, and right?
Well, is it because they were rejecting what you presented in there? Didn't resonate with them?
No, I think they just don't.
Conformist, or they just don't read.
Lack
they
of
don't
curiosity.
Read, yeah, lack of curiosity, and they don't read. And then if they read, then they would probably like read something, you know, like famous. But Indians
misinterpreted or
But Indians were really like nice to me. Like I don't.
I was like. It's a shared experience.
Yeah.
It's a shared, but I don't, I want to push back a little bit on this. Because
I feel like Indians read a lot. Like they have book clubs and they
that's
know.
That's true. I want to push back on that. The reason why I'm still at the last few chapters is because she didn't want to give it to me. And I think you'll be surprised by your community because there are women who have been generationally trapped in this kind of identity, and they pass it on, mm-hmm. and so and they've fought as well, but they may have felt defeated or felt as, you know. So I don't know. I would probably, I don't know how many, but anyway, I think you'll be surprised. Mm. I don't think we should. No, again, it is my experience,
right?
And so from, but I don't think that would be fair. I mean, I would probably say the 50-year-old me is saying that, but probably the, you know, 20-year-old rebellious me would be like, they don't understand. Mm. But anyway,
has
I wanted
your daughter read the book, or she's, I mean, like, how would you contrast your experiences or Vina's experiences of what she's going through? You mentioned that up front, right?
She was like, "Oh, Amu, it's really good, but I don't read fiction anymore. I only read Fury."
She's read like 100 pages
in college, so she's just reading
but
like Feminist Theory.
She's read 100 pages or something.
Yeah,
next generation.
Well, I talk to her a lot, and I've learned so much. I think you mentioned this in Sensorium, that you raised your father, or you were both raising
each other.
I feel like I've been completely transformed. I mean, the process of being an immigrant is transformative, because you cannot be comfortable in your skin, constantly being pushed. But the process of being a parent in America, of a smart child, sort of like would not take nonsense, was incredibly painful and joyous and transformative. So I've changed. You know, I'd be like, "Why are you wearing this?" You know, and she'd be like, "What's wrong with this? What's wrong? Why do you sexualize this? Why do you sexualize
my arms?"
Body? Yeah, and if somebody pushes back, then you think like, we should do this more often. Because if someone's like, "Why not?" then you're actually like, "Oh yeah, why not?"
To challenge it.
Yeah, right. And then she'd be like, "I like makeup because I'm an artist. So I really like, you know, doing this is my art." And then I'd be completely speechless. And then she'd be like, "I'm a really good student, so I study hard and I get to do this." And then later on, she wasn't even a good student. Like, she was just like not interested in her studies either. So you're just constantly shifting. One of my friends, I'm not naming names, but one of my friends was like, "You know, I share nothing with Bengalis. Like, you know, they have to be successful. They have, their children have to be this. The one thing I had was that my son has to be academically strong," which is for me like was just something that I never even questioned, that my child would be academically strong. And she was like, "Oh, I even gave that up." So as you grow up, you're like, you give up on gender, like, you know, like I was like, "Oh, you're not gay," you know, like that's like innate, you know, when you're a new immigrant. And then you give that up, like you just like keep changing and keep changing. And suddenly, like my brothers, I would be like, you know, bideshi bie korbana, like, you know, like I was that person.
But they did it,
I'm saying your book.
But my actual real brothers, partners,
non-Bengali,
totally, okay. And like yeah. totally.
There's some
like,
questions.
That there was like, so you change
like,
and you.
You guys can just listen in.
Yeah.
To our...
I have forgotten what my question.
Oh. Okay, and then
I
also
think it was something about
maybe introduce yourselves
not,
as your
maybe not like I think it was something about Indians read more maybe people
maybe people got really mad at that
homogenized like, Indians and what you mean by that. I think I really have to push back against that.
Yes.
And I think I really agree with what Chantuli was saying about the hunger for what life could have been.
Yes.
And reading that, I know. I mean, I certainly I don't have that kind of experience. I just did whatever I wanted to. I wore my hatkata from when I was 16, and I continued to wear hatkata. And I married my bideshi, and it was all. And my brother married, and it was all like, you know, my poor parents. Who knows how they actually felt about it? But we didn't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I forget what my point was.
You weren't. No, you were really mad that I said Indians read more than
I
Just pushing back. Dina said they don't read. I don't know about. I don't know about Indians reading or not reading.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that it's untrue that
the essentializing. And it has to do with Bangladesh-India relations as well.
Oh, true. Yeah, it's getting political. It's good. Yeah.
I mean, everything is political. As far as
I mean, for me, I was like, I belong to this community for 20 years. I've been going to your dawats for 20 years, listening to your stuff.
Yeah.
Your nonsense for 20 years. Like, your
ideas for 20 years.
Go to those places.
But I think part
of New York, that's a different New York.
No, no, I've been to all those. I know those.
I'm respecting those opinions. Like, oh, yeah. Boys and girls should not read together, and I'm nodding my head politely, or, you know, like, we go to the
Moji. I think we want to just, like, kind of a little unpack that a little bit, because I think that what you're.
We need some more.
I know, a little bit more. I think I'm a little bit like, oh, it's a little bit too. I mean, I've never been to Houston.
They're also very wealthy and very comfortable.
I think it's class. It's about rural, urban. It's a multi-layered thing. So it, and because there are like people who came during the 70s of like who were very much into the arts. I mean, it's not us that started it. I have this old picture of my dad and like a harmonium and my mother with the sari, and all the aunties were like dancing, and then like the 70s they had like bell bottoms. And so I think it's just kind of like we have some sense of like what Bangladesh is, and they carry it, and really as I think as a way of a gender control, because I remember it was a funny story. Like I was in college and I went back to Bangladesh, and I was invited to a party, and it was like sort of so college. I was like in the 90s, and I was like, oh, I should wear a salwar kameez and like look proper. And I go to this party, and it wasn't even Gulshan, but anyway, it was like just like I forget where it was. And everyone was like dressed very, and they were not from the U.S.
They were dressed in what, Western clothes?
Western clothes, right, tight dresses, and they were like, they were making fun of me, like, you came from America and you're dressed this way. And they went to
school. I wore salwar kameez in a club in Kolkata, and everyone was making fun of me. Yeah, I don't know.
But the idea that somehow that sexuality is like unlocked here, or just like, I don't know, I think. That's not what you're saying, but I think just to kind of... Wait, finding your community, I think.
I guess all I was saying is they weren't reading my book.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really
mad. But you did invite them, yeah?
I did, yeah.
To your readings?
Yeah, yeah.
You said they couldn't come from the suburbs.
I was just saying
okay,
that.
Okay, but like, oh, come on. Yeah. Did you come to my book reading? I mean, people don't come.
People don't come. No, I get the point.
It's nobody in this room came to your reading.
No.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It's like, it's fine. It happens.
Yeah.
Jiminy's experience is different from hers.
Of course.
I did grow up in Bangladesh, and I think
we're just trying to
read you.
Through that out,
yeah,
because right. You can have different kind of experiences and desires. And my father, when I got my, you know, admission, was like, go, tell. You know, it just happens, you know. There can be many strands.
Oh, so did mine. Like, all of us came to America as teenagers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I understand where Jiminy's coming from. I read Jiminy's first book, Two Women, and I thought Jiminy's very insightful, kind of like Edith Wharton kind of way.
That's
society.
Yes.
And seeing like all the little things that happen in society, it is very alive.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to reading this book.
Yes.
And I don't think the Bengali experience in America is a unified experience.
No, it's
very
not.
Fragmented, right?
Exactly.
So you have like a New York experience, and you know, the experience you were describing in Houston is very similar to, I would say, in Virginia. Like,
yes.
You know, so it's kind of like that.
Conservative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the point, right?
Yeah. So it's like suburban conservative. It's people who have come from Bangladesh, a different group of people maybe.
Yep.
And the way they grow up here, the society they've created for themselves, that niche society, maybe they don't read, you know? Whereas we're surrounded by people who do read, Bengalis who do read. So I can totally...
But we're saying the same thing, just to clarify. We're just saying that when you say Bengalis don't do this, we're universalizing an experience.
Right.
Or Indians don't do this.
Right.
This
is
how Bengalis don't come to reading.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
Right.
Because what you said is very different than your writing. Your writing is so much more nuanced.
Yeah. Right.
So I guess that's why I was like, oh.
Right.
I was taken aback, that's all. So just because you are, I think it is the subtleties, and you also have these particularities that I have. I was like, oh, I can kind of remember that. You were saying something about Mirpur Road, and I was like, oh, yeah, because that's around where my father lives. So I was like remembering like being in a rickshaw on Mirpur Road. So the specificity of, and that's why the location is so much part of your writing, that is precisely what you're saying. So I guess I was just sort of like, oh wait, like your writing is just layered and just like the location and so much detail. So then I think I was just taken aback by like, mm-hmm. oh, this general statement.
Online question.
Yeah. Ah, oh, yes.
For tonight.
Yes.
What was the journey of becoming a writer and what was the struggle to publish like?
Yes, that is
one of them. And then what is your writing practice is like?
Oh,
what suggestions do you have for aspiring writers and translators?
This is a lovely, sweet question.
I was asked by my professor, what's your writing practice? And I just stammered, what's yours?
Me?
Yeah.
So I would say the journey for me, for my novel and my second book, is that only one editor ever wanted it each time. So it was not like a big fight for my work. It was like I had one champion in my corner. Mm. And I was like, I'm going to write the best book that I can write. And that happened with Bright Lines, which was with Penguin Paperbacks, and then this book, which was with HarperCollins.
Yes.
But HarperCollins was not a good publisher to me, so I had to start again. So I've always like been kind of just starting from scratch each time. Oh. It's not like a building with a house. And I think that's kind of like, that's a different experience than other writers, and you're starting from, you know, finally working with an editor for this book. So I would say that like you just have to find one person that believes in your work. That's mm-hmm. it. That's it. And that makes the world so much smaller and easier to deal with when you know that it's not a struggle to find so many people who are obsessed with you. You know, it's just, I had one person.
Yeah.
And for my writing practice, I feel most alive at night. I'm a very sundown, sunset type of person. Mm-hmm. So after dinner, he goes to bed, my partner, he's sleeping. I light my candles, I have a little pot, I start journaling, I start dancing, I put on, like, I just get in the zone. It's very mystical. And I feel like that period until 4 a.m, I just write. Now I'm revising. Revising is different. It's more daylight hours for me. But that first draft, it always has to be in that kind of, like, partition between, like, living and dead, midnight and dawn, like, that kind of time. It's just very potent for me. So that's kind of my practice. Right now I need to get back in my practice a little bit more. I go through periods where I'm like, I can't write a word. I can't write every day. I think that's right. Not advice I give anyone. I think you should take breaks from writing and you should live your life.
Yeah.
And be a person and have human experiences. Like people that write every day, it's not gonna, I don't think that's gonna be very fun to read.
You?
Yeah, I tried for 20 years. I never got an agent. I wrote like 5 or 6 novels, and I would probably be on the borderline. So it's sort of like before you meet someone, you're like, oh, I never had a boyfriend, or, you know, and then you meet someone, and you're like, oh.
You wrote 5 or 6 novels, like separate novels?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And so I think my writing was never like something an agent would pick up. Maybe there were like, there was one agent who was interested and I turned him down because I thought
it. Like you submitted it to agents.
Yeah.
Okay, and they were like, we don't think it's
so I think my writing is very niche and it's not mainstream.
Are you working with an agent now?
No.
So that's like maybe the next step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. That's another thing with writing. It's like the agent is the person that does the things that you don't want to do.
Right.
And I had an agent who I'm pretty sure is a Zionist, honestly. And she was always like, it's okay. Don't say it if you don't want me to say it too. So, but she was always like, you're too angry. And I am like a very provocative, you know, angry at society, whatever person. And I was like, I can't work with her anymore. So then I was unagented after Bright Lines came out. I had no agent. Oh, so wow. People were like, oh, what are you working on? And I'd be like, I don't even have an agent, bro. Like, I relate to that. And then I found my next agent, and the first novel that I presented to him, he didn't want that. And then he's like, come back to me when you're ready. And then I, 2 years later, went back. So that's just how it is. Sometimes it's like, it takes this to get that next person. So I feel like now it might be the time
to go back.
To try, yeah. Or like new people that you haven't tried. Because there's so many more, like, young women of color and queer people and trans people of color in the literary world.
It's a different world.
It's a different world than when you
Who would be really?
Yeah.
I think that's been amazing.
Like the 2000s versus, and the 2000s, to the point that we were kind of jokingly talking about, it's coming out of the 90s trend of Indian writers dominating the literary waves. I mean, that was every hard-hitting writer. And that was not inclusive of Bangladeshis in that time. And that's not even, that's just facts.
Yeah, that's true.
So I feel like now...
And that experience was like universalized, like Lahiri and like, right? Like,
and Arundhati Roy, right. And all, like all of the writers, like, it's just
Amitav Ghosh.
Amitav Ghosh, yeah. Sukhati Mehta, all of them, they're all amazing writers. There's no denying that. But one of the things I found with Bright Lines, my first novel, and I don't know if you've gotten this too, is like, oh, well, we've read this kind of story before, immigrant, South Asian, this kind of thing. And I'd be like, that's not actually true. Yeah. Like, it's different. And I think that we have to understand there's an infinite variation of South Asian stories, whether they're diasporically in South Asia, right. West Indian, South African, Fijian, like, there's so many ways that we haven't explored that, you know?
Yeah. Can I go back to your point about your first agent? So did you network, or did you like reach out to the agent like Gemini had? What was your process?
With that agent, I think like someone met her at an agency and was like, I know a writer who just graduated from Brooklyn College MFA. And then I met her, and then she just like liked me, and then we worked together on my first book. And then after that, I was just like, I can't work with this person anymore. So
it was almost like a lucky coincidence.
She liked my work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's more than lucky coincidence. I think they have to really like your work because it's a relationship.
It's a business.
It's a business relationship. So, yeah, I'm lucky, but I also worked really hard, and I met her because she saw that, you know?
And Gemini, why did you turn down that agent?
So I came to a conference in New York, and there were four editors who wanted my work, and I think that was like a, I think that's a fraud conference. So there were four editors, and people are like, oh my god. So, and then they said, you know, you should go and turn that agent down because he's not a big deal. So I went and turned him down because I was like, you know, and I told him, you know, I was like, people told me that you're not a big deal. And then all the four editors turned me down. I mean, one of them left the business, like left the industry, and that happens a lot.
I heard you're not a big deal is crushing. Are you a Gemini? Okay, the name Gemini has a reason. She's jumping out of here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll go to leave. Yeah.